Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who examines world reaction to the Bush administration's unilateral rejection of a growing number of international treaties and conventions. Nathan Newman, vice president of the National Lawyers Guild, who describes a proposal within the Guild to launch a campaign to impeach the five U.S. Supreme Court justices who voted to stop the vote count in Florida during the 2000 presidential election. And Martin Butcher of Physicians for Social Responsibility, who discusses the dangers posed to public health by the military's use of depleted uranium ammunition. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Progressive magazine reports that the Bush administration is seriously considering the development of bunker-busting, low-yield nuclear weapons that might be used against leaders of so-called rogue nations. The idea is to demolish bunkers that are built deep underground, which are now protected from conventional bombing. But the use of these small nuclear devices would create a huge radioactive crater, and contaminated soil would be spread for miles around the target site. Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group, a nuclear weapons research organization, estimates that if this low-powered nuke were used against Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, nearly 20,000 people living near Baghdad would be killed. The United States would also be embarking on a new dangerous nuclear strike policy while making use of nuclear weapons in combat more acceptable. Already, two congressional Republicans, Senator John Warner and Representative Wayne Allard, have put money in the federal budget requiring the U.S. Department of Energy to study the use of nuclear weapons in small-scale conflicts where a dictator is held up in an underground bunker. Arms control advocates worry that these weapons would violate the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and will make Russia more reluctant to give up their stockpile of tactical nuclear weapons. And the bunker-busting weapons would likely be stationed in potential war zones that lack the safety checks required for larger missiles housed in silos. In a bold move to silence critics, Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has established a new communications law that will make life more difficult for independent media. Under the new Broadcasting Services Bill, signed into law in early April, the Zimbabwe government will grant only one license to a national radio or television company. The law overturns a recent Zimbabwe Supreme Court ruling that ended the 43-year monopoly for the government's Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation. The new broadcasting law, created by a presidential order, overruled a recent legislative report that concluded the government has no more right to be heard than anyone else. The imposition of the government's views on every broadcaster is an unconstitutional infringement of the right to free expression. According to the World Press Review magazine, the opposition to Mugabe has labeled the broadcasting bill fascist. Tendai Biti of the Movement for Democratic Change explained, "The increased repression which this legislation represents reflects Mugabe's declining power." In the last 2 years, Mugabe has faced increasing criticism at home and abroad after he sanctioned the violent takeover of lands owned by wealthy white farmers. Mugabe and his party, ZANU-PF, are hoping to win back the support of the landless poor, who have gained little since the successful war against white rule in the former Rhodesia. For many, Cambodia's killing fields, where nearly 1.5 million people died from disease, hunger, and murder in the late 1970s under the brutal Khmer Rouge regime, is a fading memory. At Pol Pot Security Prison 21, southeast of the capital city Phnom Penh, there are few markers to show where 17,000 people were executed. There is no museum. Only a narrow pillar of human bones in a field serves as a memorial. According to the news magazine In These Times, there is more controversy over the display of human skulls and bones than the slow pace that the killers of the Khmer Rouge are being brought to justice. By tradition, Buddhists prefer to cremate their dead and object to the open display of human remains. For years, the United Nations, which headed the peace process that led to Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen's election in 1998, has promised a full-scale war crimes tribunal. But Hun Sen has shown little interest in an investigation, even though the national parliament has authorized it. Out of frustration, war crimes researchers at the American University School of Law in Washington, D.C., have released new documentation showing that top Khmer Rouge commanders knew of the scale of the slaughter. Still, Prime Minister Hun Sen is taking a slow approach to any war crimes trial. Om Yen Tiang, a top advisor to Hun Sen, observed, "The trials will occur, in time, but the details are too important to get wrong." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Since taking office in January, George W. Bush has pursued a policy of unilateral rejection of a growing number of international treaties and conventions in the areas of environment, arms control, and human rights. His actions include rejection of a treaty creating the International Criminal Court, withdrawal from the Kyoto Protocol on global warming, a declaration that the U.S. will soon scrap the anti-ballistic missile treaty signed with the Soviet Union in 1972, undercutting a United Nations agreement to reduce illegal trafficking in small arms, pulling out of negotiations to enforce provisions of the Convention banning biological weapons, and a refusal to place before the U.S. Senate the 1996 Nuclear Test Ban Treaty and the 1993 Nuclear Weapons Reduction Accord with Russia. While the extent of the Bush administration's rejection of international cooperation is a surprise to many observers, this is not exactly a new trend in U.S. foreign policy. During his 8 years in the White House, former President Bill Clinton rejected or delayed ratification of a number of multilateral agreements, including the treaty banning landmines and the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who examines world reaction to the Bush administration's rejection of a growing number of international treaties.
This is a go-it-alone, to hell with everybody else kind of attitude. Not only is the U.S. the top dog, but we're the lone wolf. But, you know, the standard U.S. policy is to participate in multilateral institutions, to participate in the U.N. for that matter, when it serves our interests or the U.S. perceived interests or how, you know, the establishment in Washington perceives U.S. or U.S. corporate interests, and then not to participate in those institutions when it doesn't serve those perceived interests. For instance, during the Gulf War, James Baker and George Bush the First were able to cobble together an international group within the U.N. and the Security Council to support the Gulf War, so we were all for the United Nations then. But the U.S. government wasn't for the United Nations when the U.S. was mining the harbors of Nicaragua when the World Court said that was illegal. So we said, you know, World Court, who cares about that? It's a very one-sided, a very partial way of looking at the U.S. responsibilities in the world. It's relativism at its worst. But behind this Bush unilateralism is something a little even broader than what was going on with Clinton, because there's a nativist streak to it that bothers me. This idea that, they're just foreigners, you know, who cares about them? And I think that is part of a kind of a Republican flavor of unilateralism that we didn't always get with the Clinton folks. I mean, to some extent, Jesse Helms is our Secretary of State, not Colin Powell. You get this idea that, you know, it's not only a superiority complex, but there's also this sense, this emperor's resentment. Oh, those little countries over there, we're doing so much for them, and they're not jumping to our tune, so, you know, screw them.
Matthew Rothschild, do you believe this is as a result of U.S. triumphalism? You know, as the Cold War concluded, we really didn't have to deal with outsiders and their criticism?
Well, in part, you know, we've got the power, so, you know, we don't need to listen to anybody. So, I mean, it's not exactly triumphalism in that it's not as though everyone in the world says, yay, great, the U.S. is great, although U.S.-style capitalism seems to be a big export these days, the United States. It's just that we've got the power, no one else has the power, and they can't really control us. You know, well, the worst thing they can do is kick us off a Human Rights Commission now and again. But other than that, the United States has such immense, not just military power, but economic power, that we can really throw our weight around, and the Bush people are inclined to do that. That's one thing. There are also a couple other things. There's a get it fast, grab it now mentality of the Bush people and the Bush corporate people. They don't want to give international institutions power over U.S. corporations. You see this in one treaty that you didn't mention, or a convention. This is the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. The World Health Organization is trying to put forward, and the Bush administration, not surprisingly, giving its funding source, is backing the tobacco companies. And so, you know, the U.S. government, viewing its corporate clients and the people it serves, its corporate servants, interests paramount, they say, well, these international institutions may be dangerous. Not all of them, but some of them, to the ability of U.S. corporations to make a profit. So we got to stop that. Then there's what I call Kissingeritis. People in Washington are afraid that, you know, Henry Kissinger or other members of the State Department of Foreign Policy elite that may have engaged in what I would call crimes against humanity or war crimes, the fear that they, like Pinochet, are going to be dragged before, or Milosevic, can drag before the International Criminal Court. And, you know, no current Secretary of State, no current president, no current head of the Pentagon or the CIA wants to see that happen. So that's another part of what's going on.
With the perceived arrogance that you mentioned, you know, ascribed to U.S. policy and going it alone, the unilateralism, do you see that could be the impetus for any future realignment of world alliances in terms of Russia and China recently signing a pact, being very worried and concerned about the U.S. plans to abrogate the ABM treaty, Europe announcing recent plans to establish its own military force outside of NATO? Do you see that these things could pick up steam if the public continues to be turned off around the world about U.S. Unilateralism?
I do see that. I mean, the European-owned military, regional military force was going on in the last couple of years of the Clinton administration. I think that may accelerate. But again, the U.S. military pours so much money into NATO and makes countries that are in NATO, even these same European countries, comply with U.S. military planning and needs, so that a lot of these countries need to buy from U.S. military companies, that I don't think that that Europe can develop itself as another center, as a third center or fourth center, if you will. I think the thing that you mentioned, though, that is really scary is this potential alliance between Russia and China. It's not an actual alliance yet, but certainly they're getting along better. And one of the worst achievements of the Bush administration so far is to push Beijing and Moscow closer together when naturally they don't like each other all that much. And it's part of what I think is recklessness about this Bush go-it-alone, lone wolf policy, because it's making the world less safe and it's making the United States less safe. I mean, Kyoto, getting out of the global warming treaty, is going to make the world environment very unsafe, and getting out of the ABM treaty is going to make the world very unsafe as far as nuclear weapons go.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive magazine. Contact The Progressive by calling area code 608-257-4626 or visit their website at www.progressive.org. The 2000 presidential election was virtually decided when the Supreme Court voted 5-4 in the Bush versus Gore case to stop the vote count in Florida. Since then, anger at the defects in the U.S. electoral system has simmered below the radar screen of the corporate media. In fact, few questions about the unprecedented role of the Supreme Court in selecting the U.S. president have been raised by major American newspapers and television networks. Mainstream commentators, by and large, have urged critics unhappy with George W. Bush's bizarre road to the White House to get over it. Some activists have turned their attention toward correcting the flaws in the U.S. electoral system by proposing measures that include abolishing the Electoral College, instant runoff voting, and modernization of election machinery. But not everyone has forgotten what many critics view as the blatant partisanship of the Supreme Court in the Florida decision. The Executive Committee of the National Lawyers Guild recently recommended that Guild members undertake a nationwide campaign to impeach those five conservative Supreme Court justices who voted to stop the state of Florida's vote count. The proposal, already endorsed by the Democratic Party of Oregon, will be voted on by Guild members at their national convention in October. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nathan Newman, Vice President of the National Lawyers Guild, who explains why he is advocating the launch of a campaign to impeach Justices Rehnquist, Scalia, O'Connor, Thomas, and Kennedy.
Bush v. Gore shocked so many people when it came down, just because, to be honest, most people looked at it and, like legal scholars, most conservative and liberal beforehand said there was no legal basis for the decision. When it came down, it was frankly surprising and shocking to even mainstream lawyers. Now, for a group like the National Lawyers Guild, which has a more progressive view on where the law should be, it was more an example of where the Supreme Court has become an essentially lawless institution.
Now, what would be the mechanism by which you would undertake an impeachment proceeding against these particular five Supreme Court justices?
If there is sort of the political support and general commitment of a range of progressive groups to do this, the first step is to build the sort of political support across the country. And then impeachment is the same process people became familiar with in the last few years. You go through the House. House members bring a bill of impeachment. If a majority of House members vote to impeach, the five justices are then impeached. They're not removed. Impeachment is actually the first step. If they're impeached, it goes over to the Senate, where there's a trial, and it would then take a two-thirds vote of the Senate to actually remove them from office. I mean, I think it's worth understanding, especially where the National Lawyers Guild. This is not for us whether Al Gore won or whether George Bush won. That's actually relatively irrelevant. What is the issue is that people were denied their votes.
I would imagine that there'd be many Democratic legislators in both the House and Senate that would be reluctant to put their name on this proposal, given that it's quite dramatic, maybe thought of as radical. Certainly the media has told us time and again that there's really no need for further action or angst about the election in 2000. A lot of people have bought that line, particularly those in power in Washington. Is your feeling that this effort to impeach should be undertaken, whether you could realistically win or not, just to go through the trial and discovery and to make the point to the nation and the world that we don't take our democracy that lightly?
Well, look at two parts. One is the short term, one is the long term. I think it's quite reasonable to say in the short term, unlikely to remove these people from office, especially with 50 Republicans in the Senate. However, what is happening right now is as the Supreme Court goes after these decisions, civil rights decisions, labor decisions, they are essentially attacking the legitimacy of a whole set of progressive values, progressive laws. And just to challenge them ideologically, to say these are not legitimate people, they have acted illegitimately, will also help say that the decisions they're making are not legitimate and will help in that fight to preserve those laws and to override them in a number of different ways. I mean, the Supreme Court, as people have noted in the past, when they're not creating the election returns as they did last fall, as people say, also follow the elections. I mean, they worry about their legitimacy. To the extent that you attack them, they will yield. They are not a completely isolated, depoliticized institution, as we saw last fall. So a political challenge to them will have that short-term effect. But the longer-term effect is this. I mean, you have to put this in some context. I mean, you know, in the early part of this century, for example, 1905, where there was a classic case called the Lochner decision, which at that point the Supreme Court said you can't have maximum hour laws. You know, if an employer wants to force people to work 80 hours a week, we're not going to let you legislate to stop that. It took 30 years of struggle until the New Deal, basically 1937, before the Supreme Court was forced to back off of those kinds of decisions. Not coincidentally, 1937 was the year the National Lawyers Guild was actually established, and one of its first acts at its founding convention was to call for restraint on the power of the Supreme Court to strike down laws and just because it didn't like them.
Nathan Newman, in your view, how much damage has been done to democracy with the Bush versus Gore decision by the Supreme Court?
Well, it depends on how strong a state you thought it was in before that. I mean, I think what Bush v. Gore did was reveal the state it was. I mean, before Bush v. Gore, we didn't know 2 to 4 million votes that were cast were thrown out. We didn't know that these sort of irregularities were happening. We didn't know that if you were in a poor community, your votes were much less likely to count than in a rich community. Well, I shouldn't say we didn't know. Some people knew and had been arguing about this problem for years, but it brought it to national consciousness. So at one level, you can argue that what Bush v. Gore did is not damage our democracy, but give us an opportunity to improve our democracy, to actually understand the lessons that came out and actually do something about it. And that's the debate we're trying to have, to say, you know, what do we do with the Supreme Court? But more broadly, looking at the role the courts, our election systems have had, to build a real new democracy movement in this country, to talk about making sure not only every vote counts, but every person counts, that civil rights are enforced, that average workers have the same say as somebody with $1 million in our system. Because it isn't just a question of making votes count, it's a question of making sure that economic inequality isn't used to deny votes as well.
That was Nathan Newman, Vice President of the National Lawyers Guild. Contact the Guild by calling area code 212-627-2656 or visit their website at www.nlg.org. Depleted uranium, as its name implies, is less radioactive than the enriched uranium used in nuclear weapons. But DU, as it's called, is the subject of growing worldwide concern among public health officials due to its carcinogenic properties and because its effects on human health and the environment are not thoroughly understood. DU is now used by many nations in both offensive and defensive weaponry. It was first widely used in the battlefield during the Persian Gulf War, when U.S. forces and their allies employed DU weapons against Iraq. NATO forces again used DU ammunition in the ethnic conflicts in both Bosnia and Kosovo as the nation of Yugoslavia broke apart. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Martin Butcher, Director of Security Programs with Physicians for Social Responsibility, a group founded more than 20 years ago to oppose the nuclear arms race. Butcher explains why his group is concerned with the use of depleted uranium weapons and what he believes should be done about it.
Depleted uranium is a form of waste from other uses of uranium, particularly from uranium used in either weapons or nuclear power. It's less radioactive than enriched forms of uranium that are used for those other purposes. And it's used for many things in society today, from ballast in aircraft to the use which has come to public notice over the last year or two in weapons. And the reason it's used in both defensively, for example on tanks as armor, and as an effective penetrating weapon, say to be fired from an aircraft, is that it's a very dense metal, a very heavy metal. For its size, it has a heavy mass, and it penetrates effectively through armor.
Has it been used over many years? I know it first came to light that I'm aware of during the Gulf War.
Yeah, in fact, it has been used for many, many years. It did, as you say, first come to public prominence in the Gulf War, though it had been in use before that as an armor on tanks, for example. It's been in use that I know of since early in the 1980s and possibly before that as a material used in artillery shells. It's been around for many, many years. Its first large-scale use, though, was during the Gulf War. Then again, we saw in the war over Kosovo more recently.
And what impacts does it have on human health? And also, I believe there are concerns about environmental impacts.
Yeah, there are concerns of environmental contamination, which lead on to concerns about human health. There is a big debate going on at the moment about the the effects that depleted uranium can have. I think there is one kind of situation where it's certain that there are dangers to health, and that's, for example, on former battlefields in, say, Iraq, where there are tanks and other armored vehicles that have been destroyed with depleted uranium ammunition. The dust that gathers inside the tank as a result of the impact of the shell is radioactive and is easily ingestible. Those dust particles, the radiation, they migrate to sensitive areas of the human body, such as the thyroid, and can cause cancers.
Isn't depleted uranium being used currently in attacks on Iraq from U.S. and British military planes?
It would depend on the kind of targets that they're striking. If they're bombing a runway or something, then no. If they're bombing armored vehicles, then yes, it's very likely.
What is PSR's position on depleted uranium?
PSR believes that there is reason for concern about depleted uranium, and that there should be more studies done about the health effects and the environmental effects of this kind of ammunition, and not just indeed as ammunition, but as tank armor, as ballast in aircraft, and its use in general, and that while those studies are being done, this material should not be used. It's a precautionary principle. If you believe that there's a possibility that something might be doing damage to human health, you should stop using it while you find out whether or not it does damage to human health.
Can you make a connection between the possible dangers, or what you know about the dangers of depleted uranium, and the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the elements that were used in those bombs? What's the relationship?
Well, the bombs that were used at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one of them was a uranium bomb, but that was highly enriched uranium. That's a very different, much more toxic, much more radioactive substance. That's extremely dangerous, and we're seeing now that the federal government has admitted, after nearly 60 years of the production of nuclear elements, radioactive elements, and nuclear weapons, that merely working with this substance to produce bombs can poison enormous numbers of people working in those factories. And now the compensation plans are just coming in this week for those workers who have been made sick. But depleted uranium is a very different substance, and you can, for at least a short time period, safely hold it in your hand, for example. It's when it gets inside the body and into particular organs that it becomes dangerous.
That was Martin Butcher, Director of Security Programs with Physicians for Social Responsibility. Contact the group by calling area code 202-667-4260 or visit their website at www.psr.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics or guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Monat, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.